This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, we try to sort through all those pro and con messages about Proposals 2 and 4.
There aren't that many universal truths out there, but one of them is you should not base your voting decision on what you see in TV ads.
Plus, we'll meet one of the candidates for Michigan's Supreme Court. And we talk with blogger John as he brings us fascinating, touching stories about the people and places of Detroit.
Despite the crime or despite all the horror stories we hear, there's a whole lot of people in the city who are just regular folks trying to get by.
And we meet a little boy who's helping his hometown tackle some big problems. He knows you can do big things even though you're small. Those stories and much more on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome. This is Stateside for Thursday, October 25th. I'm Cynthia Canty. Certainly hope you are enjoying this incredible Indian summer day. Today we start our series looking at the ballot proposals that we all face on Election Day, just 12 days from now. We'll lead off by digging into Proposals 2 and 4 with Michigan Public Radio Network Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Plus, we'll meet Detroit blogger John as he uncovers fascinating stories of people and places in Detroit. And we'll meet a little boy who wanted to help his struggling hometown in a big way. You're going to love his story. But first, amidst the heated presidential race, the candidates running for U.S. Senate, Congress, or the State House, and those ballot proposals, it seems voters could be overlooking a very crucial part of Michigan's ballot, the candidates running for Michigan Supreme Court. Today's Detroit Free Press reports in a horse race poll of Supreme Court candidates conducted earlier this month, an overwhelming majority of Michigan voters said they didn't have any idea who they would vote for. So we are going to bring the Michigan Supreme Court candidates to you. We begin with Justice Stephen Markman, who was appointed to the state's high court in 1999 by Governor John Engler, and he has been reelected twice since then. Justice Markman, welcome to Stateside. Let's start by talking about the time you've spent on the court. What have you been proud of over the past 12 years, and what do you think has worked?
I think during the past 12 years, the Michigan Supreme Court, which has had what I call a rule of law majority, almost always by a 4-3 balanced, has strengthened considerably and reformed our criminal justice system. It's restored individual responsibility as one of the foundations of our civil justice system. It's reduced wasteful and unnecessary litigation, and it's sustained the reforms of the legislative and executive branches of government. And again, those actions have almost always been done by a 4-3 vote. And I mention that vote only because I think the debate this year, as it is in most recent campaigns, has been between judges such as myself who believe in the rule of law, which is that our decisions and our resolution of disputes is based upon the written law, the law of the Constitution, the law of contracts, the law of statutes, whereas I think our opponents have a much different understanding. I believe that they would bring to Michigan a rule of judge court in which what's most important is not the law, but the personal views and preference of the individual judge.
What role do you think, Justice Markman, that the judiciary should be playing in state politics?
Well, I don't think it should be playing any role in politics. We obviously get cases from time to time in which there's some political implications, and I think our obligation is never to administer Republican justice or Democratic justice, but to read the law faithfully and let the chips fall where they may, and I think we've done that. I think we've decided many cases that have whose results have been preferred by one party, in many cases whose results have been preferred by the other party, but I don't think we have a role in politics. I think, in fact, we ought to make sure that the court never becomes a place where we're doing politics by another name.
And what's your opinion of future Supreme Courts overruling past Supreme Court decisions?
Well, there's always a balance there. That's a good question. There's always a balance there. On the one hand, every system of law has got to respect its own past precedents. Otherwise, the law just can't be maintained in a stable and predictable fashion. On the other hand, courts sometimes make mistakes, and judges also have an oath to the law and the Constitution, and there are times in which they have to look at precedents and say it's time that that precedent be revisited and sometimes changed. Every state Supreme Court, as well as the United States Supreme Court, has to deal with that same kind of tension. Normally, you defer to the past precedents of the court because that's necessary for a stable system of law. On the other hand, there are extraordinary occasions on which you have to revisit and sometimes alter those precedents where you believe they've been decided wrongly.
Justice Stephen Markman, in the time you have been on the bench at the High Court, what do you think are the one or two most significant state Supreme Court decisions and why?
Well, I think the most significant contribution of the court over the past 12 years has perhaps come in two areas. And it's hard for me to pick out a single decision, but I think that about half of our cases involve criminal justice matters. And in the criminal justice realm, I think we've really transformed and strengthened the criminal justice system by making clear that the standard for reviewing trials in the state is not a perfect trial, but it's a fair trial. I used to be a prosecutor in Detroit, and I know it's extraordinarily rare that you're ever going to get a perfect trial. And if that's going to be the standard for our review of what happens in the trial courts, I mean, we're going to be requiring new trials all the time. The standard is, the constitutional standard, however, is not a perfect trial. It's a fair trial. And I think this court has reiterated what has always been the constitutional standard. And we've corrected, I think, an imbalance that was established by some of our predecessors. Secondly, this is a court that has respected the judgments of the other branches of government. You take, for example, a variety of reforms that we've addressed in the past decade or so in areas like medical malpractice and automobile no-fault and tort reform and property law reform and criminal justice reform and on and on and on. And disproportionately, those cases have been decided by a 4-3 vote, and we've sustained those reforms. We've sustained those reforms because we believe that we, the people, through their elected representatives, get to make public policy, and that this is not the responsibility of lawyers in black robes sitting on the court. So I think both in the criminal justice system and in sustaining the reforms of the legislative branch, this court's made an enormous contribution to improving the legal system in our state.
Let me just ask you as we wrap up here, what do you feel the biggest challenge is that the state Supreme Court is facing going ahead? Let's get past this election and look beyond. What's the biggest challenge?
Well, I think it is important that we maintain a rule of law Supreme Court in which you know, there's no thumbs on the scales of justice and no partisan decision-making. And I think that is part of the debate that we're seeing this year, because I believe where you have a rule of judges in which judges get to make their own decisions and sometimes trump the law, the equal rule of law is diluted in that process. But perhaps even more importantly, I think from a public perspective, I think the integrity of the court is constantly and increasingly being challenged by the large amounts of money that are being drawn into judicial campaigns. I mean, each of the candidates, of course, raises some of their own monies, but those monies are dwarfed by the amount of monies that are being raised by outside groups and which basically conduct negative campaigns. Now, there's nothing wrong with negative campaigns, and people have the right to free speech, and they can campaign negatively or positively as they choose. But the important thing to understand is that when you have so much money, literally millions of dollars now coming into judicial campaigns from all directions, it becomes increasingly difficult when those judges need to sit on cases and make decisions on those cases to avoid somebody saying, well, you decided this way because you received money from this lawyer or this party, or mm-hmm. your opponent received money from that lawyer or that party. And I think increasingly that is calling into question the integrity of the court with many citizens, although I would emphasize that I don't think there's any justice on our court who would ever be influenced by that kind of thing, but there is the perception that maybe that's occurring, and I think that's a problem that the court needs to address.
How would you?
Maybe the legislature needs to address it as well.
And how would you fix that problem, that perception of partisanship, that concern about fingerprints on things?
Well, that's the $64 question. I think, first of all, there needs to be a debate on that because there's lots of different ideas that people have about this. I mean, on the one hand, contributing to political campaigns is sometimes tantamount to speech. That's how people communicate their support for particular points of view and their passions for candidates. I think we need to revisit what exactly the people want our process to be for selecting justices. Do they want the current electoral system in which candidates have to compete for office in a democratic electoral environment? If so, necessarily you're going to have to raise significant amounts of money for campaigns. Do we want an appointed system in which you would probably not have so much money involved in you would not have any money involved in campaigns, but on the other hand, justices would not have to go on shows such as yours. They would not have to go out among the people and debate their positions and engage in exchanges about what court should do and what court shouldn't do. I guess I'm inclined to think there's some middle-type positions, and one that I'm interested in, although I'm not completely committed to it, is something called the Missouri Plan, in which we don't have these kind of competitive partisan elections that have become so contentious, but you have a system in which the question before the voters is, shall we retain Judge Smith or Justice Jones? And yes or no, should we retain that individual? And it seems to me that that's increasingly been the preferred course of action in a number of other states, and I'd be interested in knowing how effectively that's working, and both requiring that judges have to go out among the people and defend themselves and explain their thinking, while trying to avoid some of the excesses of the political contribution system.
It sounds like you have suggested a future conversation that we're going to be having here on Stateside. We may perhaps could get you back to expand on that again. We thank you for your time, Justice Stephen Markman of the Michigan Supreme Court. Thank you for speaking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
And be sure to stay tuned to Stateside all next week as we continue our conversations with the candidates for the Michigan Supreme Court. On Monday, we talk with University of Michigan Law Professor Bridget Mary McCormick. And we want to connect with you. Find us online at michiganradio.org. You can go to Facebook and search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. And I'll remind you again, it's C-A-N-T-Y. And we're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. Still to come, you have likely seen the flood of TV commercials for and against proposals 2 and 4. We'll dig deeper than a 60-second commercial and find out what these two ballot proposals mean to us here in Michigan. Plus, how are things between cities and towns and their public employee unions? We'll get a temperature check coming up in about 10 minutes here on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Well, this year has certainly a big election year for ballot proposals in our state. Come November 6th, we'll decide the fate of 5 proposals and 1 referendum. So today and all next week, we'll look at these ballot proposals. What's in them? What would they do to our state constitution and laws? And who are the people and the groups pushing for and against them? We begin today with a look at proposals 2 and 4, both involving labor groups and issues of unionization. And Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta is here to help us sort out what's in these two proposals. And Rick, I have to say, I have heard more people say, I don't understand these proposals, largely because of the absolute flood of TV commercials. Sometimes you'll see a pro-commercial followed instantly by an anti-commercial, and somehow they both make sense. So let's tackle 2 and 4. What's in each?
Proposal 2, the really short version, is it enshrines collective bargaining, the right to collective bargaining in the state constitution. It was a response by labor unions to a lot of things that we've been seeing coming out of Lansing by the Republican majorities there and the Republican governor that got right down into, you know, dealing with things like how unions collect political contributions or dues from their members. Now, it doesn't really have an effect on unions and private companies like, you know, the United Auto Workers
Sure.
and the car companies, because those are already protected by federal law. So, you know, really, you know, where the game is at in terms of Proposal 2 is public employee unions. So once you get past the right to collectively bargain, there's also a lot of other things in there that seek to, you know, contain or even reverse You know, one of the counts as many as 170 laws that have been passed dealing with, you know, various aspects of labor agreements between employees and employers.
Well, now, don't public and private sector workers already have collective bargaining rights in Michigan?
Well, sure. Yeah. They have collective bargaining rights because we are not a right-to-work state.
Right.
And so what this is supposed to do is preempt a right-to-work law in Michigan, and then it also goes beyond that and says, and by the way, some of these other limitations that, you've been creating around union rights, you know, for example, collecting dues, collecting political contributions, it also gets at that. And that gets to the ads that you're talking about. You know,
yes.
I think one of the most famous ones or infamous ones is the claim that it would make it easier for child molesters and people with drinking and drug issues to work in public schools.
Yes.
And certainly it would potentially affect those laws that have been passed to enact that. I guess the question is, you know, do you believe that a school board isn't going to bargain for really tough sanctions on people who are like that?
Sure.
So really, it opens up so many things. Now, I mean, for example, one that comes to mind, and I haven't gotten a great answer on this, and we're not going to have great answers on a lot of this.
I've gathered that.
Because once the amendment is passed, everything's still got to be litigated. Anytime someone tries to say that this law no longer applies because of the amendment, it'll very likely go to court. So we're going to see if this passes a lot of litigation on what applies and what doesn't.
So the wording is nebulous.
Well, this year we have a lot of constitutional amendments that really get quite technical. And when we talk about Proposal 4, certainly that's one of the ones that we're talking about. But, you know, there's supposed to be the broad parameters. And amendments are typically what's called self-executing, meaning no other action is required to make them effective. But there's still a whole lot of arguing about what they mean.
Okay.
And that's going to be true of all the amendments.
And talking about, too, when you see about these commercials – they're incredibly confusing. Firefighters, breathing apparatus. Well, of course, who doesn't want their local firefighter to have all the gear
he or she
needs?
One of the arguments that's always been made about collective bargaining, and that's true in everything from police and firefighters to teachers, is one of the things you bargain about is working conditions. You know, if you're a teacher, you might have your union bargaining about
class size. Sure.
If you're a firefighter or some other public safety officer, you might be bargaining for training. And what they're saying is, especially the public safety officers are saying, and in this case, we're bargaining for our lives and safety against people who sometimes are just looking for the least costly way of doing something.
Fair enough. And you say, well, of course, who wouldn't be for that? And then you see an ad against with a firefighter and you are just left with your head spinning.
Well, look, I mean, there aren't that many universal truths out there, but one of them is you should not base your voting decision on what you see in TV ads.
And they certainly are trying. And speaking of ads, we'll talk about Proposal 4. Who wouldn't want sweet grandma to have the best home health care? So talk Proposal 4.
Proposal 4 is an effort by unions, the SEIU in particular, to get its members into the Medicaid-funded home health care assistant business and do it by basically having the state set up the union, even though – and it says right in there that these workers would have the same rights as civil service employees, but they are not to be considered public employees. And so the rub is it's a state-created union. Now, what – the union focuses on is the registry, that this creates a registry that people have to have background checks and they have to be trained and qualified before they go into the registry, and that it's basically a wise consumer choice question, that you're creating a registry where people can go and search for people that you know are going to do a good job at this. Now, very often, you know, the people who are compensated for this kind of care are family members.
Correct.
Does that mean they have to join the union? So, you know, there's all of that out there. And, you know, one of the big questions that gets asked, the SEIU is doing this because they couldn't get what they wanted out of the legislature. And so the opponents of this, which are, you know, largely, business groups, efficient government groups, things like that, are saying that just because you don't get what you want out of the legislature, does that mean you should get to lock it into the state constitution?
Basically doing a big end zone run and trying to lock it into the constitution. And the point of
But the people have to vote for it.
So they have to decide. And the registry, by the way, would be created by dues-paying members, because isn't that what the critics are saying? Isn't this a chance to fatten union coffers, if you will, by dues?
Look, it's no secret that the union movement has been on the wane and they're looking for new places to go. And the healthcare industry has been a prime target. And this is a segment of that industry.
Something that I have heard asked, and people can't figure it out from the commercials or even from the reading. How would life change for anyone in Michigan, your average citizen, should either of these pass?
Well, certainly you would see a lot of things, a lot of issues relitigated on the labor front. And if you are a union member or, you know, someone who believes in that, who thinks that it ought to be, you know, easier for unions to do things like, you know, collect dues, and that these ought to be issues that are bargained between the employer and the employee and not governed by acts of the legislature, especially Republican legislators who are essentially hostile to organized labor,
sure,
then you're probably, you know, sympathetic to it. If you believe that Michigan should be a right-to-work state, certainly Proposal 2 is not your cup of tea. Certainly, if you think that it's okay for the government to step in and, you know, set these tighter parameters around what unions can and cannot do, especially in the public environment, then you're going to take a different take on it. There is a home health care worker registry, you know, with or without the Prop 4 amendment, but it's not as extensive or expansive as what's there. And if you're searching for someone to do that kind of work, that you don't have someone in mind to do it, certainly it would be a place to go and shop for it. You know, the question is, do you really think that that needs to be in the state constitution? And does it have to be done via a, you know, what's essentially a state-sponsored union?
Overall, would you say, you've been covering politics a long time, is this one of the more confusing years for ballot proposals for voters?
You know, ballot proposals are always confusing. People put them on because they have a vested interest in it, and people oppose them for the same reason. And they cherry pick their claims that political ads are not designed to be illuminating.
We have to remember that, because I think the public has this idea that, yes, well, watch this and I'll be enlightened.
No, no. Political ads are not meant to be informative.
So we'll keep that in mind. Well, thank you, Rick, for helping us kind of sort out proposals 2 and 4.
Kind of.
Kind of.
Hopefully, if it hasn't been less confusing, at least the confusion is more interesting.
There we go. As always, Michigan Public Radio Network's Lansing Bureau Chief Rick Pluta. Thanks for talking with us, Rick.
My pleasure.
And talking about Prop 2 and its focus on public employee unions raises another question. How are things between your city or town and its public employee unions? It's the kind of question that when things are going well, you barely think about. Things in your city sort of hum along in the background. But when tensions are on the rise, perhaps to the point of a strike or a slowdown, then you notice. Maybe trash isn't getting picked up. Maybe it's blue flu striking the ranks of a city's uniformed police officers. Well, a new study from the University of Michigan took a temperature check of the attitudes of local leaders towards their public employee unions. Co-author Tom Evacco joins us. Tom, let's start with a fact that really caught me off guard. Only 27% of Michigan's local governments actually have a public sector labor union. I guess I would have thought that was a much, much higher figure.
That was surprising to us as well. Most people think of Michigan as a very labor-friendly state, given the history of the labor movement here around the auto industry. So, yeah, we were surprised by that, and we think most people who read the report are going to be surprised that only 27% of our local governments have unions. Now, these are general-purpose local governments, counties, cities, townships, and villages, not school districts. They would have a higher percentage.
And where would they be concentrated, these unions?
Most of the unions in local government are in larger jurisdictions, and so when we think geographically, that tends to concentrate them in southeast Michigan around the Detroit metro area. But we do find them throughout the state.
And your report is based on interviews of local leaders done in, I see, spring 2011 and spring 2012. So How are things? How are these mayors and top local executives feeling about their unions?
The interesting thing to us is, in the view of local government leaders here in Michigan, relationships are pretty good at the local level between the jurisdiction and its employee unions. You know, when we see things like the Chicago teacher strike over the summer, I think a lot of people are going to just kind of conclude that, you know, it's a very divisive relationship at the local level. For the most part, that's not the case here in Michigan. Local government leaders say that the relationship between the jurisdiction and the unions are positive. 66% say that relationships are positive, including 16% who say they're excellent.
That would be surprising, particularly reading headlines out of Detroit.
Yes, that's right. We see you know, there certainly are cases where relationships are very frayed. Even in smaller jurisdictions, it happens. But overall, you know, among the majority of local governments that have unions, relationships are pretty strong in the view of local government leaders. We didn't interview labor leaders, so they may have a different take on this.
Now, more than three quarters of these jurisdictions have negotiated, I should say, with their unions in the last year. So what did they report to you about the way the talks went?
Well, we asked about four different topics of negotiations: employee pay levels, fringe benefit rates, staffing levels, and work rule changes. And on each of these four different topics, the outcome of negotiations was that the unions made concessions much more frequently than the jurisdiction did. And that's particularly the case on fringe benefits. In jurisdictions that negotiated over fringe benefits, 69% report that the unions made concessions, and only 5% report that the jurisdiction made concessions. So a very one-sided outcome on fringe benefit concessions this year.
Why do you think that is?
Well, we think it's driven by a number of things. Part of it is likely to be driven by changes in state law. Since the beginning of Governor Snyder's term in January of 2011, state government in Lansing has enacted a series of laws that we think are impacting this relationship at the local level and kind of tipping the balance of power towards the jurisdictions and away from the unions. So we think that's part of what has driven some of these concessions. But quite a few of our local government leaders with unions told us in their jurisdictions, the unions understood the money's not there, revenue has been falling, and they came to the table ready to make concessions because they understood that the jurisdiction was in severe fiscal distress. And so they were looking to help in quite a few cases.
So it's, shall I say, a pleasant surprise to realize that things can go smoothly and layoffs don't have to happen and concessions are given and things keep chugging along, hoping, I'm sure, for better days.
Yeah, this, again, is pretty surprising to us that the view of local leaders is relatively positive. Now, we ask a couple of questions of local leaders about their view of the impact of unions in terms of the fiscal health of the jurisdiction and in terms of the overall performance of the jurisdiction, operational performance. And there are definitely concerns among local leaders that unions can have negative impacts on these kind of issues, fiscal health and performance. But over the last year, the view of local leaders has improved on both of those factors. They think unions are not as much of a liability as they did a year ago on either fiscal health or performance issues.
So it seems attitudes of local leaders toward their unions are fairly sanguine. So what does this mean for residents?
Well, that's a very good question. If I was a resident in a jurisdiction that was in severe fiscal distress and I thought that the unions perhaps hadn't given as many concessions, I would want to know why. You know, I think the data that we've gathered show that in most places that are in fiscal distress, unions have made concessions this year. So I would dig into it a bit further and find out if concessions were not made in my jurisdiction, why is it? Is it that relationships are bad and the sides don't trust each other? Is it perhaps that concessions were made in the previous couple of years and so the jurisdiction didn't feel the need this year? It could be a range of things. But I think our data shows where interested citizens can kind of take a next step.
69% of local leaders you found saying only the unions made concessions in the last round of talks, yet you discovered a very hefty percentage of municipalities are planning to seek new and more concessions in the coming year, which leads to the question, when is enough enough? Because it seems the reward to the unions for accepting concessions is, guess what, we want more. Is that a fair argument?
I think that is certainly a fair question to ask. If I was a union representative or a unionized employee in local government, I'd be asking the same thing. When is enough enough? In many jurisdictions, employees, both unionized and non-unionized, haven't had raises in a number of years, have been giving back on fringe benefits and retirement packages and so on. And so, yeah, I would be worried. You know, what's coming next? Haven't we given enough already? Are there other places that the jurisdiction can cut, or can revenue be raised?
So you spoke with the jurisdiction leaders. Perhaps we might get a somewhat different story were we to talk to some of the public employee union leaders.
That's right. We really don't have a good idea of how the local union officials or unionized employees feel about these things. I think it's probably fair to assume that they're not happy about giving back fringe benefits and retirement packages and not getting pay raises for a number of years.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a tough time in Michigan, and I think the indication is that most unions have been pretty responsible lately.
Interesting food for thought from the Center for Local, State, and Urban Policy at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy. And Tom Ivacco is the co-author of this survey, really looking at the Michigan Public Policy Survey and finding out Michigan's local leaders pretty satisfied with their union negotiations. Thanks for talking with us, Tom.
Thanks for having us on.
You are about to meet a little boy who could teach a lot of us some pretty big lessons on caring about your hometown. A little local hero named Joshua. That's coming up in 10 minutes. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. To anyone who has driven through the streets of Detroit, have you ever taken a moment, or maybe more than a moment, to look, to notice? Notice hardy small businesses or homes, perhaps in neighborhoods that don't look at first glance like they could support, say, a family-run bar or maybe a florist shop in someone's living room. John Carlisle has taken the time to look, to notice, to knock on a door, and then to uncover stories that are fascinating, touching, surprising. Stories about the people and some of the forgotten places in Detroit. John's writings are well known to readers of the Metro Times, where he files his stories as Detroit blogger John. He's taken 42 of those stories with great photographs and put them in a book called 313, Life in the Motor City. John Carlisle, how did you come to be the guy who will knock on a door and discover the people and the stories behind that door?
Well, you know, the coverage of Detroit has sort of dwindled over the years. And being a Detroiter and being a journalist, when I would talk to people on the streets, they would always say roughly the same thing. They'd say, you guys always write about, and by you guys, they mean the media in general. They say, all you guys write about is Kwame or shootings. And so they were always very reluctant to talk at first, and they distrusted the media. And to me, they had a point that, you know, despite the crime or despite all the horror stories we hear, there's a whole lot of people in the city who are just regular folks trying to get by. And I never really saw stories about them. So I kind of just set out to write about people that you'd never hear of, people who are either keeping their neighborhood alive or sustaining a business in the city or just somehow doing something positive that somehow kept things going.
For folks who are listening who have not had a chance to read your pieces in the Metro Times, and now they're together in this book, 313, Life in the Motor City, I want you to give us an example of one of these great people and recap for us one of my favorite stories. It's called A Day of Rest. The back room of a little Detroit shop becomes one man's oasis. Talk to us a little about Mike Sherdell.
Well, he was one of my typical finds, which is, you know, I'll often just hop in the car and drive around or get out, I'll park and walk the block and just knock on every door. And there was this little antique shop over on Meringue on the east side, and it just so small and buried, and I don't even know if it has a sign. And it, like a lot of places in Detroit, they're nondescript and hidden unless you know about them. And he's a guy who came over from, he immigrated from Iran years ago, I think maybe 30 years ago, and worked in New York, and, you know, the classic immigrant story of working 2-3 jobs to make it, and he wound up in Detroit, and I believe he was a landlord for a while, but he opened this antique shop, which was kind of his real passion, and now he's older, he's well past retirement age, but it's one of those cases where this is all he knows, this is what he's got left, and this is his life. It's been that for so long, there's really no reason to give it up. But he's in such a bad area that there's really no customer base for him, except for the handful of people who may have known him through the years. And so I spent a couple of days with him, and it was just this sort of sweet portrait of this elderly man who spent his days in the back room. He'd watch satellite TV from the Middle East, or just, you know, have his prayer beads in his hand saying prayers and sip his home-brewed tea. And it was just this placid scene where he would live out his days in this quiet solitude. And to me, that was very touching.
It was. It was extremely touching. You also tell us the backstory of a business that I have seen a bazillion times. I grew up in Ferndale, so going up and down Woodward, going to the then University of Detroit, and I would pass the donut shop, the Dutch Girl donut shop, and here you told us the story that there really was a Dutch Girl.
Yeah, you know, it turns out it was started, like a lot of those old businesses, maybe, you know, decades ago, by a woman who's now considerably older, but she was from Holland, and they called it Dutch Girl Donuts. And it was one of those places that, especially being on a main drag like Woodward, a lot of us pass going to and from the city, but, you know, because the neighborhood's foreboding, a lot of people won't stop, or you can see through the lit windows at nighttime that there's bulletproof glass, and that intimidates a lot of people. But you go in there and you find that it's just this hardworking family that's kept this business going for years and years, and it's just that the neighborhood changed around them, but inside there it's exactly as it was decades ago. And so these places are almost like little time capsules of what life was like before, and that's one of them. And so she still comes in, and you know, she's this sweet elderly woman, and her family runs the business, and they make donuts like they used to 50 years ago. And that's what I try to capture in the book, which is there's a lot of little places like that still alive that a lot of people who haven't even been to Detroit in 20, 30 years might still remember and probably don't know are actually still there the same as before.
I'm talking with John Carlisle, whose book 313, Life in the Motor City, is just full of delicious profiles, 42 stories of people and businesses and forgotten places in the city of Detroit. John, we talked about some businesses. You also find some of the interesting personalities, the people. Talk to us about Mr. Bowtie. I love Mr. Bowtie.
Yeah, he was great, and he was another guy that I just found by driving by, and he kind of captures that can-do spirit or do-it-yourself spirit of a lot of Detroiters, because right now there's not a lot of opportunities out there, and so a lot of people have to sort of create their own. And he's a guy who came up with this sort of niche career, which is polishing headlights on cars. And it's one of those things that a lot of people don't think their headlights need polishing, but he insists that a car looks better if the headlights are clean. And so he came up with his own shtick, which is to dress up in a red bow tie and like a tuxedo outfit, basically red pants, red shoes. And he will stand on the corner of a street, say somewhere along 7 Mile, and try to beckon people over to get their headlights cleaned. And it's what's funny about it and what's challenging for him, it's a 27-minute process. So it's not so easy to snag someone who's on their way somewhere to stop for 27 minutes to watch this guy polish their headlights and do this task they didn't even know needed to be done. And so it was a touching story because it's like this uphill battle for this earnest guy who's trying to make a living, trying to make this business he came up with take off. And so the time I spent with him was fascinating because it was really just watching a salesman get rejected one time after another. And finally, as I write in the story, finally somebody says, okay, you can do it. And you can just see the relief on his face. And he goes through this elaborate scenario where he'll take pictures of your before and after headlights. He'll print them out for you. He'll sign them. He'll put his business card on the back. It's this whole elaborate procedure, but it's so charming because he's so sincere about it and trying so hard to make it. And some people will actually stop just for that. They don't even need their headlights clean, but they'll admire the fact that this guy is trying so hard to make a living the honest way that they'll give him the money and let him do the service just on principle. And so that became the story. And he is like you said, a very fascinating Detroit character.
John, what do you think your stories and your photographs say about, first of all, the people of Detroit?
Well, I hope, I capture it, but I try to capture the, you know, I don't want to say the positive side, because some of the stories aren't always happy stories,
right,
but just the real side of Detroit, the real people that don't take part in the sensational aspects of the city, whether it's corruption in city government or whether it's the high crime in the neighborhoods. It's just regular people trying to get by with what they have. And especially now in Detroit, with so many challenges, especially with city government so broke, there's not as much you can rely on from the city. The trash doesn't always get picked up. The streetlights aren't always lit. The police don't always respond to 911. And so in many ways in Detroit, you're on your own. And that can be a good thing and a bad thing, because it's a good thing because you're free to do whatever you want in a way. You can become Mr. Bowtie, or you can throw a blues concert in an empty field, or you can become the neighborhood patrol watch. But it's also not good, because when you need help, it's often not there. And so, to me, it really captures the resilience of people when faced with these challenges, the things they can come up with to keep their neighborhood and, by extension, their city alive.
I would imagine that you would, if you could, issue, let's say, a challenge, for lack of a better word, to our listeners from other parts of Michigan who either haven't been to Detroit, or they go to Detroit, they go to the Joe, see the Red Wings, go to Comerica Park, see the Tigers, and then get out. And they're not stopping to really look. They're on the freeway and they're heading out of town. And I suspect if you could, you'd like to issue a challenge to those folks.
Well, you know, it's a mix because, a lot of people will come in. There's the main arteries that you can get off right at the casino or right at the stadiums, and then you hop right back on. And it's sort of you're in a safe little zone. But there is something to be said for getting out off those arteries and onto some of the main roads or secondary roads and seeing what's out there, especially for people who used to live here and do remember some places, because they might be surprised a lot of them are still there. A lot of the old bakeries or old restaurants or, you know, little retail shops. And, just using common sense like you would in any big city, there's a lot to be said for getting out and exploring. And you can, you know, use your instinct and see that this area isn't so bad. There's not a gang standing on the corner. So go ahead and get out and see what's going on in this bakery. You might be surprised who's in there. It could be someone who's been there 70 years, which I found, or an antique shop that has things you will not find anywhere else in the country because nobody knows it's there. So these items sit underpriced or underappreciated in this little shop. And it might be something you've looked for forever, but never thought to look in Detroit. So there's so much to discover, and hopefully the book points directly to some of them, but even for people who just want to find things on their own, a quick drive can yield so many surprising discoveries, and I do encourage that.
And you did allude to the security aspect, because that is clearly something that someone coming from the outside is going to say, will I be safe? I mean, you've heard it, and I've heard it, the people who say, well, I wouldn't go south of 8 Mile. It's that feeling is out there. So address that concern that people might have about security. Have you ever felt, in danger or afraid as you have prowled the neighborhoods?
Well, I grew up here, so I think I have a sort of instinct for what are the better areas, what are the worst areas, and what situations to avoid. But I've still run into trouble. It might be partly because I seek it out. I go to a lot of the very bad areas just to see, what life is like there. But, I mean, I'm still alive. And I go out unarmed, and, I'm walking around with a very shiny, expensive camera, and, I stand out, and a lot of it's demeanor, and a lot of it's just knowing where you should be and where you shouldn't be. But for the most part, a lot of the crime is crime of opportunity, and you're going to get that in any urban setting where there's a lot of poverty, or, even more negatively, some people who have addictions and they're desperate for money, and it's just like it is anywhere in any big city. In some parts of Detroit, it's more than it is in other cities, but you just kind of have to use common sense. And really, in the daytime, broad daylight, if you're exploring, you really shouldn't run into too much trouble. And just, again, using common sense, you could have a very nice, adventuresome day.
The book is 313, Life in the Motor City by John Carlisle. It was a wonderful read, and it's something that I know I found in years as a news reporter in Detroit that you get talking to people, you go down a street and you think there's nothing here, and then there is the immaculate little house with the beautifully painted picket fence and flowers, and maybe there are bars in the window for security, but there's a sense of pride, and you realize someone's saying, I'm making a stand and I'm going to live my life here. I have to, so I'm going to make the best of it. And it's a wonderful way to meet the real people of the Motor City. John Carlisle, thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you so much, Cynthia. I appreciate it.
And on the note of trying to seek out interesting, inspiring people and share their stories, one of the goals we had when we launched Stateside was to shed light and salute the folks who are doing their bit to make Michigan a better place. Kind of local heroes. Whether that local hero is 9 or 90, we want to share what they've done with all of you. Our first local hero is actually 10. He's Joshua Smith. Joshua lives on Detroit's west side. Earlier this year, Joshua decided that he wanted to help his hometown cope with its financial crisis. Let's start by saying hello to Joshua's mom, Rhonda Smith. Rhonda, you have to be so proud of your boy. He drew attention from across the country and really around the world, all because of his lemonade stand.
Yes, he has, and I am so very proud of him.
Tell us a little about where the idea began, and when he came to you first?
He did, yes.
And said what?
He wanted to know why the city of Detroit was in a crisis. He had heard that on the radio, so he came home to ask me what the crisis was about and what was it that we could do to try to help the city. And knowing that it was a huge problem, I just told him we needed to pray. So he did. And one day he told me, I had this idea. And I said, oh, really? And he said he was reading a book. And in the book, some young people had a lemonade stand because they needed money for computers for their school. And he said, wow, I could do that for the city of Detroit. I can have a lemonade stand and raise money for the city of Detroit.
And that idea really took off. What, he'd hoped to raise about $1,000. What did he ultimately raise? You got people from everywhere.
Everywhere. He raised more than $3,600, and the monies came in from all across the country and even outside of the country. We had donations from South Africa and England, so it was just pretty amazing.
And then there's a payoff happening in a local playground. Tell us a little about what PlayWorld is doing.
Yes. And they were watching ABC Nightly News, and they saw Joshua's story there. And the director, the sales director's wife, was watching it along with the sales director and said, you know, you got to get that kid a playground. And so they started the ball rolling, and next thing I knew, we got a call and found out that they had put things in place to donate a playground for one of the parks that Joshua raised money for.
Rhonda, let me ask you this. What message has your little boy sent out, do you think, that has captured so many people's hearts?
I think it's the message that he likes to say over and over again. Even though you're small, you can do big things. And it doesn't even mean that you're small in terms of your age, but if you feel inadequate to be able to do something, that you still can do it. And so there's hope. Even when things look dismal, there's hope.
Can we talk to Joshua?
Oh, sure.
Hello?
Hi, Joshua. This is Cindy. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good. I guess you're getting pretty used to getting interviewed, aren't you? You're kind of a big star now.
Yes.
Joshua, tell me, when you were driving with, your mom says you were driving with your grandpa and you heard talk of Detroit being in a crisis. What did that mean to you?
I didn't feel so great then. Well, I didn't want us to be extinct, just like dinosaurs aren't. And
you felt you had to do something, right?
Yeah, I wanted to do something, and my heart just broke on that.
Listen, I have to ask you, what would you say to other kids who hear bad news and just think, boy, things are bad? What would you say to them?
Well, that you can do something. Just step up to things that are bad. Like you can do big things, like my mom said, even though you're small. So step up, figure out what your plan is, think it all through your mind, like be in a huddle in your brain, and then you write it down too. So people, that's a way that you can hope.
Joshua, you're a cool kid. Thank you for talking with us, and you are our first local hero here on Stateside.
Thank you.
And we want to feature more local heroes like Joshua on Stateside. So if you know someone who's doing something, anything that deserves the spotlight, please email us, stateside@michiganradio.org. We want to look forward to sharing stories with you from all corners of Michigan. We'll be right back. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty saying, go Tigers. Let's hope we have a happier result. Thank you for listening, and let's talk again on Monday.